You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin hospitals saw more than $1 billion in unpaid medical bills last year, a 14% increase from the year before. We'll find out why more care is going unpaid for and how the costs get passed on. First, Election Day is getting closer with just under a month before voters head to the polls. The Marquette University Law School poll has been tracking the statewide races in this year's midterm elections. The results from their latest survey are out today. Charles Franklin is the poll's director and the founder of Pollster.com. Charles, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here.
Well, let's dive into some of the big ticket races, Charles, that people are watching for, and start with the race for governor. What did you see? What's been changing?
Well, this month we have a toss-up, 46% for Evers, 47% for Walker. That's obviously well within the margin of error. We had a one-point margin. A month ago, or 3 weeks ago in September, Evers led 49-44. So the shift is down 3 points for Evers, up 3 points for Walker. In our August poll, we had the race a dead tie. So I'd say over these three polls, we've seen some hint that Evers might have an advantage last month, but we're back to a clear toss-up this month. So the upshot, I think, is that this looks like a very competitive race. Other polling of the race has shown large Evers advantages of as much as 7 recently, but also as little as 2. So there's been a range of polling in the race, but I think a toss-up is about where the race looks right now.
Now, when you are tweeting out the poll results, I'm watching for those, and I'm also watching for the first people to say you oversampled members of one party or the other, and that explains the results. Can you talk about how you sample by party and how that fits into the final product?
Sure. Well, almost all polling that uses legitimate random sampling draws the sample as well as we can, but doesn't declare ahead of time what the party balance will be, and that's certainly true of my polling. So the party split that we get is a result of what people tell us in the particular survey, not something that I get to make up what I think the party balance in the state would be. And so it is what it is. The movement from last time to this time is a movement from a Democratic advantage in the previous poll to a 3-point Republican advantage in the current poll, and that's inside the margin of error how much it moved from last time to this time. But it does affect other things in the poll. The key point to remember here, though, is that we saw the governor's race move in a Republican direction, which you might think is because of the party makeup of the poll, but there was no movement in the Senate race, which was a 11-point Baldwin lead last time and a 10-point lead this time. And on the Attorney General's race, we actually saw the race move to be tighter from a bigger Republican advantage to a smaller Republican advantage. So there's no question that the partisan makeup of the poll could affect things at the margin, but it can't be the explanation for why one big Democratic advantage, one toss-up, and one small Republican advantage, and they move in opposite directions between last month and this month.
Let's dig into those Senate numbers a little more. You were out in the field basically as Brett Kavanaugh was being confirmed, right? The big story that people are watching for and trying to figure out how this is going to affect the races for Senate around the country.
That's right. And first of all, we were in the field bracketing when he was confirmed, but we saw no change in opinion about him from before the Senate voted to after, and so that doesn't appear to have changed things. Opinions have more polarized on Kavanaugh. Both his favorable ratings and his unfavorable ratings have gone up, and on balance, people told us that they would oppose his confirmation if they had a vote on it by 43-47. But we don't see that those changes are reflected much in the movement that we did see in the governor's race, for example. When it comes to enthusiasm, Democrats still hold a lead in enthusiasm by about 7 points in this poll, but Republicans did move up a little bit more from the last poll when Democrats had an 11-point advantage. But tying that directly to the Kavanaugh hearings, I think, is not something that the data really supports.
And I mentioned a Democratic response to seeing that tight governor's race. I saw a Republican-leaning group say, well, this Senate here, the Senate poll was before the Senate debate between Tammy Baldwin and Leah Vukmir. Historically, do you see in a Senate race a debate being something that moves the needle a lot?
Generally not, but it certainly can. We finished our poll Sunday night, and so it is entirely before the debate. We'll be having a series of debates for both the Senate and the Attorney General and the governor's race between now and the election. So all of those could potentially move the electorate. In general, people watch debates and feel reinforced to support the candidate that they already favored. But sometimes you'll see something, an issue or a statement that a candidate makes that emerges as a pretty big thing. And it's impossible to know ahead of time which it is, when it will move a race and when it won't.
Before we move on from these statewide elections, you mentioned the Attorney General race. Incumbent Republican Brad Schimmel still leading, but a gap, it sounds like, narrowed a little bit. But given that it's not the top-tier race, do people know who the candidates are at this point? Were there a lot more don't-knows or undecideds than those other ones?
That's right, and there is a big gap there. Schimmel had led by 7 points 3 weeks ago and leads by 4 in this race. That's inside the margin of error. But what we do know is that Josh Call, the Democratic candidate, is still unknown to 81% of the respondents in our sample when we just ask, do you have a favorable or unfavorable opinion, or haven't you heard of this guy? Brad Schimmel, though, is unknown to 46% of the public. That's much higher than either the governor or the senator, Senator Baldwin, are. And that shows that as important as the Attorney General's office is, arguably the second most important statewide office, nevertheless, the Attorney General is not someone that becomes a household name usually. And that's certainly shown here. The other side is the ad war, and news reports this week say that Call will be out with a large advertising campaign from now to Election Day. That gives us a great opportunity to see how much that introduces him to the public, as well as the Schimmel campaign's own ad campaign, and how these awareness of these two candidates may change over this last month of the campaign.
Talking to Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette University Law School poll. They have new results out today. Did any third-party candidates move the needle at all in this month's survey, Charles?
So far, not very much. We do ask about the Libertarian candidate for governor, who's getting 5% in this poll and 6% in the previous poll. The one thing that does stand out about that is that independents are giving about 11% to Phil Anderson, the Libertarian candidate. And that's, of course, exactly where you would expect a third party to be getting votes, is not from partisans, but from independents.
Let's hit a couple non-directly election-related questions you ask. You ask people about their attitudes toward Foxconn and what it was going to mean for the Milwaukee area and the state as a whole. What are we saying about Foxconn?
There's been very little change in attitudes towards Foxconn over the course of this year. 48% say that we're paying too much. 38% say we'll get our money's worth from it. 61% think it's going to boost the Milwaukee economy. Only 30% say it won't. But then on the question of whether Foxconn will mean businesses in your area benefit, 57% say they won't. 35% say they will. That last number has been similar to this all year. But it did start at 25% saying local businesses would benefit. So that has moved up by 10 points over the year, but still a very substantial majority saying that they don't see benefits of Foxconn for their areas.
You also polled people on opioids, I think for the first time. What kind of things did you find out?
Yeah, we asked, do you think the state has done a lot to deal with opioid addiction? Only 11% said a lot, but 31% said they've done a fair amount, 25% only a little, and 17 said almost none, and about 11% said they didn't have an opinion about this. I think this shows that while the state has done a variety of things in legislation over the last few years, this is not an issue that voters are especially familiar with. And the balance of 42% think that they've done a lot or a fair bit, and 36% not so much, reflects the fact that this is not something that voters have special opinions about at this point. Now, it is being talked about a bit in the Attorney General's race, and so this is an issue that might change as a result of the campaign talking to voters about it, and if the candidates debate how we've handled the issue, that too could help inform voters about how the state is dealing with opioids.
Before I let you go, Charles, do you have another survey coming out between now and Election Day?
Oh, yes, we sure do.
All right, we'll watch for that. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Very good. Thank you.
That's Charles Franklin from the Marquette University Law School poll with us to give us the results of their newest survey, which came out earlier today. Coming up, we'll find out why more medical bills in Wisconsin are going unpaid and how hospitals are dealing with it. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out why unpaid medical bills are on the rise in the state and how hospitals are absorbing those costs. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the story of a family farm in northeastern Wisconsin.
Russell and Chris Allen just finished their 43rd season running Allen's Allenville Produce, a farm and farm stand operating in Winnebago County. As Russ considers retirement, he and his wife reflect on what farming means to their family and their community with Stephen Kircher of UW Oshkosh. This piece, which includes recordings of them preparing for a farmer's market, is the first in a series from the Lands We Share Farming History Project.
So where's Russ this time of day?
They're
out in the fields?
They're picking corn, so they're almost done. Because I have to leave here in 20 minutes.
As I've learned, there's no sense of complaining, just do it.
It's like today I met several people that come out twice or three times a week and just love coming out, and I ask them about my retirement often, and I ask people, what would they do? What would you do? And they basically say they don't know. And I don't know either. You know, my wife would like to retire, and it's neither one way or the other to me. You know, I thought that part of our life was lost when our boy passed on. So what I do one way or the other doesn't matter that much to me. It's just do as well as you can at whatever you're doing and trying to have everyone included. You know, that's kind of how agricultural is. You have to help the next person because it's pretty hard to make it on your own. You know, the neighbor. I remember when the tornado came and decimated Quentin Swenson's barn. And Quentin Swenson actually worked for Allen Farms in his later years. And the whole community went over there. And I remember standing right in the barn and helping them, and we rebuilt the whole barn.
What did Obama say? We're not going backwards to the 50s. Things move on. Let's get with it. Sandia, keep up a walk. As you see on the farming community, you better know Spanish nowadays.
Está bien, 30, hay mucha.
Sí, hay mucha de allá.
¿Otra?
¿Otra?
Yeah, because there's somebody coming. Stocks, bales.
Yeah, we'll get it.
All right, watermelon. Could be some people today. Some people today. If you can't sell a pumpkin today, you can never sell a pumpkin. I don't know how, but his vegetables are better. And I always knew that too. And after a while, when people would say, oh, it's Allen's stuff, it's really nice to hear, but then you also go, I know, I know. And I wonder if after a while, Russell himself knows when you're asking what he produced, while we're along on the dream, he's still the one. We clerked, we grew stuff, or we helped him. That's the one. I still say I would give him that. I hate to admit it.
Why don't you tell him that while he's here?
He's told me that I'm a horrible person.
No. It's actually going in the opposite direction.
No, I went the total opposite way. I said, it's all you. We're all along on your ride.
And I don't know where I'm driving.
That That story was edited by Craig Ely and comes from The Lands We Share. It's a traveling exhibition and community conversation tour on farming and history brought to you by four University of Wisconsin campuses. It opens this week at the Oshkosh Public Library. More information can be found at landsweshare.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, a report from the Wisconsin Hospital Association found that last year, unpaid medical bills in hospitals around the state rose to a total of $1.1 billion. That reverses the downward trend of the past bunch of years. Healthcare advocates are pointing to recent changes on the federal and state level as possible reasons for the shift. Shemaine Mills is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. She's been covering this issue. Shemaine, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, let's start off with where these unpaid bills come from. What are the sources of that in hospitals?
Well, mainly it's two areas. It's bad debt and charity care. You can think of it as people who can't pay, they can't afford to pay, and people who don't pay. And it's not necessarily, I don't want to pay this bill. It may be a problem with medical coding. There's a lot of administrative and bureaucratic processes in getting these bills out and paid. So, I mean, if you think of it as can't pay and don't pay, that's uncompensated care.
And this is something that hospitals have to keep track of and report on, correct?
Right. Every year they have to do a report, very detailed report that talks about charity care and bad debt. And the reason Congress makes them do this is hospitals get a very substantial tax break. And the reason they get the tax break is because they provide this charity care. So they have to prove that they are indeed providing charity care.
Talk about the arc of this unpaid medical issue in hospitals over the last handful of years.
Well, it saw its lowest point in 2015. And this was shortly after the Affordable Care Act expanded insurance for a number of people two ways, by expanding Medicaid and then also by providing insurance reform so more people could get insurance without being denied. So basically, you had millions of people covered across the nation, and so hospitals saw more bills paid. People were able to afford to pay them.
Right, because one hypothetical case might be someone goes in to get medical care, gets billed for it. It turns out they didn't have insurance, or the insurance they had doesn't cover that issue, and they can't pay. The hospital ends up holding the bag.
Right, right. There were fewer instances under the ACA where insurance companies could deny claims. So you had more of those claims paid.
Now, we have the latest data, and that's the subject of your new reporting on this. This is up to 2017, is that right?
Correct.
What did we see last year?
Over $1 billion, $1.1 billion. So it's a lot of money. And what's interesting is,
this is $1.1 billion just in Wisconsin.
Right, right. That's a good point to make. Across the nation, it's $38 billion. So, I mean, it's a lot of money we're talking about that hospitals aren't getting money for the medical services they provide. And in Wisconsin, it hasn't reached this level since 2014. And that, as I said earlier, was when the ACA started. Now, that's not the entire reason. You can't say that's the only reason we're seeing medical debt rise or fall. There's also prices. Medical costs are going up. We're told the economy is faring better, but wages have been stagnant.
And do we know how this is distributed around the state?
Well, the brunt of it's in Milwaukee County. 30% of all uncompensated care is in Milwaukee County. Now, of course, it's the most populous county.
But it's not 30% of the state.
Right, right, exactly.
I double-checked that. Yeah, so it's a disproportionate amount in the biggest, and it makes sense. It's in many ways the highest population of low-income people in the state.
Exactly, so you have a double whammy.
Are there efforts in the works to try to deal with this problem and try to bring down this unpaid medical debt at hospitals?
Well, there are a number of things. One of them, of course, was getting more people insurance. Governor Walker has also tried to lower premiums. We've seen a spike in premiums under the Affordable Care Act and through something known as reinsurance, which is a fancy way of saying basically the federal government and state is subsidizing some of these high-cost medical claims. But that is only going to affect a portion of the market. It's not going to affect a widespread swath of people.
What impact does this unpaid medical debt have on hospitals and the care they provide? The $1.1 billion doesn't just magically disappear.
Well, like everything else, they pass it along to you and I. I mean, it's a business, and they have to recoup these costs. So people that do have insurance are seeing a little boost in their bills.
You've been reporting on this issue over the years. Is this something you get the sense of for politicians and healthcare providers? This is something they see as an urgent, hot-button issue, or is this just something that's kind of a steady drumbeat? There's always going to be some debt out there.
Well, we've seen debt higher than this in previous years, and there wasn't really action to deal with it. So now it may come to a head just because healthcare is such a big issue in this election. However, you see pre-existing conditions taking more of a prominent role. Bad debt and the business side of things is less so. However, unpaid medical bills could crop up again.
Chimene, thanks for shining some light on this for us.
Thanks, Rob.
Chimene Mills is a reporter for WPR News. She joined us to talk about the rise in unpaid medical costs in Wisconsin that topped $1 billion in 2017. Coming up, results of a new study find that while many adolescent girls feel more empowered to pursue a variety of careers, boys seem to continue to feel constricted by gender norms. We'll learn more in just a bit. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 6 on The Morning Show, if you're out for a drive in rural Wisconsin, you may need to drive a little more carefully this time of year. Join the show for a look at road safety during harvest season and how cars and farm equipment can both do their jobs safely. It's tomorrow morning after 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the stereotyped 1950s household roles of men and women are mostly a thing of the past, but how much have our ideas about gender roles changed since then, especially for the youngest generations? A survey commissioned by Plan International USA asked adolescents aged 10 to 19 to find out what it means to be a boy or a girl in today's society. Claire Kane Miller is with us, correspondent for the New York Times, where she writes about gender, families, and the future of work for The Upshot. She wrote about the results of the study in a piece, Many Ways to Be a Girl, But One Way to Be a Boy. Claire, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be here.
Also joining us is Tressa Undum, a partner and co-founder of Perry Undern, the nonpartisan public opinion research firm that conducted the research. Tressa specializes in understanding public opinion toward gender equality, healthcare, and other policy issues. Tressa, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Tressa, we talk about a lot of surveys here on the show. It doesn't seem like there are so many surveys asking adolescents, kids age 10 to 19, questions. What were you looking for in this poll?
Yeah, it's a good point. It's a very difficult survey population to survey. You have to get parents' consent. It took us, we were in the field for 2 months. It's a very rigorous survey and takes a lot of resources. So kudos to Plan for commissioning it. We wanted to really just explore. I mean, this was almost like an academic study. We wanted to explore the views and experiences of girls and boys when it comes to sexism, gender equality. We asked about social media. We asked about online porn. We asked about, do you feel judged as a sexual object? And we probably had over 100 questions in the survey. It was a really robust survey of, again, just trying to figure out how teens or 10 to 19 year olds, teens and younger adolescents feel and experience issues related to gender equality.
And Claire, you write a lot about gender. Looking at this report, before we dig into some of the details with Tressa, was there anything in here that really struck you?
One thing that really struck me is that girls have clearly received the message that now we've been, you know, teaching girls for a couple of generations, but it was very heartening to see that they've received it, which is that they can be anything they want to be. They can do science and math. They can play sports. You know, they can become leaders. In fact, girls were slightly more likely than boys to say they saw themselves becoming a leader. So these things seemed like a really good development. On the other hand, girls were extremely likely to say that society valued them most for their looks and that they felt unsafe as a sexual object. So clearly they're getting this mixed message. And the other thing that struck me is that boys seem to have been left out of this conversation about gender equality almost entirely. The messages that they're getting are really the same messages that they were getting in the 50s, it seems like. You know, don't show your feelings. It's important to be strong and tough. Boys don't cry, this kind of thing.
Tressa, let's start with the girls' side of that equation. Claire, laying out kind of a good news, bad news story. Can you tell us a little more about what girls in this survey had to say about their wider access to different gender roles, but also the downsides of being judged for their appearances, the fear of, in reality, of sexual harassment?
Well, just like what Claire said, I mean, when it comes to their ambitions and their life goals, girls are far more likely to say it's a very important life goal to have a successful career, way more likely to say that than have, you know, a goal is to get married and to have kids. In fact, just they're just as likely as boys to say a career is important. As Claire said, a little bit more likely to say consider themselves a leader and all of those positive things. In terms of, you know, one of the most surprising things to me in these data is just the degree to which girls and boys are in an environment just immersed in sort of the sexualization and objectification of girls and women. But yeah, as Claire said, so boys get the message that the most important trait in boys is strength and toughness. Girls, it's being physically attractive. Half of girls look in the mirror at least once a day and imagine how others might see them. That's compared to 31% of boys. And I was speaking to this environment, this sort of sexualized environment. Two-thirds of girls say they're exposed several times or more to women and girls in the media who have unrealistic bodies. Half say that several times a week or more they see female characters in TVs or movies whose bodies and looks are more important than their abilities. A majority of girls say they hear boys making sexual comments or sexual jokes about girls at least several times a week. And when you look at teen girls, so 14 to 19-year-olds, 47%, so almost half of teen girls say they hear boys making sexual comments or sexual jokes about girls every day. And even one in four younger girls hears these comments every day. And boys pretty much say the same thing. They say, you know, they're likely to hear these comments in Hollywood. They're likely to hear males, characters in TV in Hollywood making sexual comments and jokes about women. Half of boys ages 14 to 19 have heard male family members make sexual jokes or sexual comments about women. And especially hearing those comments, sexual jokes and sexual comments about women is correlated with a lot of surprising things in the survey too, and sort of other types of pressure around you know, hiding your feelings and having less egalitarian views toward women and more likely to feel it's okay to ask a girl for a naked or sexy picture. So, yeah, we have a lot of findings there around just the climate around women, girls, and you know, sexualization and objectification.
And Claire, you also spent time interviewing several sixth grade students, so at the lower end of this age range surveys, and you talked to them about their experience with gender. What kind of responses did you hear? How did they match up with these survey results?
They were actually in eighth grade, but very close to that age, and they really reflected what the survey showed. So at this middle school that I went to, there were a couple girls on the football team. Girls made up the vast majority of the student council members. They said they wanted to be, you know, scientists when they grew up and lawyers when they grew up. They said math and science were their favorite subjects. They said they really felt that they were equal in school and in their lives to boys, and people treated them that way. And so that confidence was on display. At the same time, they said that despite all that, they felt that what society valued most in them was their looks. And, you know, they felt either that they were hearing from their parents, you know, it's important to grow up to be a good wife, or they were hearing, you know, from the media that being physically attractive was the most important thing, or they were hearing from boys who, you know, asked them for sexy pictures on a regular basis by text message, things like this, where they were really getting those double messages that the data found. And then the boys I interviewed, it was slightly heartbreaking because they, you know, some of them talked about how they played sports and they thought, you know, being tough was, they also had a disconnect where they said most important to them was to be confident and ambitious, but they thought that what society valued more in them was to be tough and strong. And some of them played sports and said they didn't feel comfortable expressing their emotions except when they were playing sports, and then they felt like they, you know, could give themselves the freedom to get fired up, as one said. Others who didn't play sports said that they felt a lot of pressure to do so. One said that he didn't feel like he was a real man because he wasn't physically strong and he didn't do activities like that. He had started a coding club at school and wanted to be a computer scientist, and was really feeling the pressure that this was not the traditional expectation. One said that he had wanted to play volleyball, and apparently that is a girl's sport, and so he had been made fun of for that. And so, you know, what the survey found, what other research has found, and what these boys described to me is that there's much less flexibility for boys. There are much narrower roles that they're expected to be in, and going outside of those roles at all, you get a lot of feedback that that's the wrong thing to do, in a way that girls' roles have really expanded much more.
Talking to Claire Kane Miller, correspondent from the New York Times, and Tressa Undom, the lead researcher from Perry Undom, who led a study of the views and experiences of young people related to gender. And that's what we're talking about. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you in this age range, 10 to 19? What do you think about what you're hearing? What do you see as the expectations of boys, the expectations of girls in your school, in your group of friends? Do you have the freedom to be and do whatever you'd like, do you think? Do you feel pressure to act a certain way? And if you're a parent or teacher, love to hear your perspective on this as well. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about a new study that asked adolescents how they feel about gender and gender roles in today's society. Claire Kane Miller is with us from the New York Times. She wrote the piece, Many Ways to Be a Girl, One Way to Be a Boy. Tressa Undom led this research on the study asking people aged 10 to 19 their thoughts on gender. You can join in on at 800-642-1234. If you are a young person yourself, or a parent or a teacher, what do you see going on in your community, in your schools? What are the unique pressures that girls and boys face? Do you feel limited by who you are? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tressa, before we go to our callers, I want to pick up on what Claire was saying about boys earlier, this lack of flexibility. In this survey, did you get a sense that boys were kind of policing each other to stick with that perceived gender role?
That's a good question. I don't know that that's something that we could uncover in the survey. But as Claire said, we did ask, you know, and most of the interviews were conducted on the internet, either online through smartphone or whatever. So I don't think there was a lot of, you know, I think we got some pretty honest answers, but we did ask about, you know, do you feel pressure from friends, from parents, from teachers to be a certain way? And And as Claire said, 72% of boys in the survey feel that pressure from others to be physically strong. Boys feel pressure to dominate and be in charge of others. Boys feel 44% of teen boys feel pressure to be violent, to be willing to punch somebody if provoked. So these stereotypical, you know, as Claire said, sort of decades ago, what you would think, we're still seeing boys feeling pressure to do that. I think that sexual comments and sexual jokes, that is probably something that is, you know, there's sort of a group effect there. And about 40% of teen boys say they feel pressure to hook up with a girl. And probably a lot of that comes from peers as well.
And in talking to eighth graders, did you see that too, Claire, how boys might pressure other boys in these situations?
Yes, absolutely. That's where they said they heard a lot of these messages. You know, you shouldn't be on the volleyball team. You know, coding is, you know, dorky. You should play sports. Those kind of messages. They were hearing them from other boys. They were also hearing other boys, you know, make sexual jokes. It's, you know, about how they appeared to other boys. And I also interviewed a number of social scientists for my story who've studied this age group, and they said that policing is one thing that they definitely see among boys, sort of policing one another as a way to enforce some of these societal expectations.
Let's bring on a caller now. Kelly is with us in Cascade. Kelly, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, and thank you for this very important conversation. So my situation is a little unique. We have two young daughters. In the past several years, I took over working full-time so that my husband, who had pursued a career, he left the arts, he wanted to pursue the arts. That was not encouraged when he was younger. He eventually went into banking, which is a very male-dominant job. He left a three-digit income to be a stay-at-home dad. So I went back to work full-time, you know, went through getting all of the benefits. He is a stay-at-home dad. He's taken up cooking. He's kind of jack-of-all-trades. It's a completely thankless job that he really has taken it on, and he's gotten a lot of flack from a lot of people over it. Either people are just passively watching to see how that goes or...
Interesting. I'm going to jump in, Kelly. So we've got an adult feeling some pressure on gender roles, but I wanted to ask about maybe role models. Are kids seeing men and women in different roles now? And maybe that influences what they think of gender roles. Tressa, do you see any of that?
You know, I think we asked in your household who does most of the cooking, who does most of the cleaning, and frankly, it still tends to be the mom who does most of those traditional roles. We also asked outside the family, you know, what famous woman do you most look up to? And we said famous because we wanted, you know, we didn't want them to say their mom or a family member. But are there role models out there, women role models, and sort of what roles are they in? The biggest response is no, there are no famous women I look up to. 51% of kids say that, respondents say that. And then the next most common answer is a celebrity actress or a singer. So again, not quite, so, you know, I think when I think about that, when they're seeing still some traditional role models in their home, and then they're looking at the famous woman, the sort of role model they're looking at is a celebrity actress and singer, who they are also more likely to say, you know, those women are valued a little bit more for their bodies or have less, you know, less realistic bodies. I think that's telling.
In our last few moments, Claire, did you see that, the role models kids pointed to when you talked to eighth graders?
Yes, they did say that some of them who came from more conservative families said that they were getting, you know, pressure to perform more traditional roles. And they were saying that older people, like their parents, just didn't understand that younger people were doing things differently. But a lot of them also said that they saw people in their lives who were doing different roles, that they knew a couple stay-at-home dads, that most of the mothers that they knew worked outside the home. And from the social science research that I've read on this, it says that, you know, your actions speak much louder than your words to children. So if you say, you know, boys and girls, men and women should share the load, boys and girls can do whatever they want, but in your house, the man, you know, goes out and makes the money and fixes the car, and the woman does 100% of the cooking and the laundry, then those are the messages that the kids are going to pick up. So.
And that's a good place to leave it. Thanks to both of our guests, Claire Kane Miller from the New York Times, Tressa Undom, partner and co-founder of Perry Undom. We've been talking about the research that Tressa did on gender roles and attitudes surveying adolescents age 10 to 19.